And basically the approach that we're taking in the working group is we basically figured it's impossible to actually study in depth all non-indigenous foreign insects and diseases and quantify their economic impacts. And so what we're doing is we're trying to just focus on the frequency distribution of impacts. So we figure there are a lot of species that have very small impacts, a few that have really big ones. We're calling these poster pests. And the idea is if we can figure out how far out on this axis, how big the big impacts are, and if we know how many species are back here, then we might be able to come up with some kind of crude estimate of the overall impact. So that's basically the approach that we're doing. And so to do that, a lot of it is coming up with these poster pests, but also identifying how many of these pests of lesser significance there are. And so far, and this, to be honest, is very, you know, sort of a work in progress kind of thing, but so far we're estimating about somewhere 478 non-indigenous species, and I might add that most of this information comes from a list that Bill Mattson and Pekka Niemelä and others developed several years ago. Of those 478 non-indigenous species, there are maybe around 60. We really haven't settled on this. And basically species that somebody has noticed. That doesn't mean that sometime later we'll notice that some of these other species do have noticeable effects on forests. But most of the species, the non-indigenous species, are with no question, are ones that nobody has ever really noticed any, quote, damage. That is, any real either ecological or economic effect. And then in the very far extreme, we've identified these three poster pests, that is the ones that have extreme impacts. And in this list, we basically separate them into these different guilds of defoliators, sapsuckers, and wood borers. And for each of these guilds, as sort of the extreme impacts, we're identifying gypsy moths, HWA, and emerald ash borer. We're also considering pathogens to be one guild, which is kind of embarrassing for the pathologist, but there just aren't enough of them to. So a lot of this list making is actually, you learn very interesting stuff. So this is basically a map showing the current, so basically assembling the distribution of all these known pest species in the GIS. And basically this is, if you overlay all the distribution of all the known non-indigenous pest species, this is what it looks like, which I think is really a beautiful graph, if I must say myself. Probably the most important thing is the colors here. It's always very important to get your right colors. But the other thing that's very interesting when you look at this is that you see there's this area in the Northeast which has a much higher frequency of non-indigenous pest species. And of course, I think it's one of these, when you look at this, everyone could say, I know why. I think the reality is there are many reasons. No doubt, part of it, there's a much longer history of human habitation, of higher human population densities, and people trading with Europe and this sort of thing in the Northeast. I think there may be something, you know, possibly a consideration too, is the fact that most of the forests in these regions are deciduous forests, which tend to have a higher diversity of overstory species than, say, in the West. And maybe that has something with the accumulation of more species. But it is a very interesting thing. Another interesting thing that comes out of this, and I should mention that Deb McCullough sent me this graph that she did this using, and again, this is mostly based on data from Bill Mattson and others, is basically if you look at the timing of when each of these non-indigenous species was first discovered, this is the time series. So you can see, obviously, starting about 200 years ago, we've had this very steady increase, but surprisingly, it actually dropped. Maybe, I tend to think maybe this had something to do with World War II, there are fewer people looking, then increased, but then it's actually gone down again. And I would have to admit, you know, in terms of making an argument for a problem out of control, this doesn't necessarily look like, you almost think, we have it under control. Whether this trend really is real or not, I don't really know. In terms of sort of making the argument that it's out of control, I think most of us usually prefer to show a graph like this, which comes from Saylor's 1978 publication, which shows, you know, the accumulation of, these are all exotic species, not just forest species, of accumulating. I tend to think that that one of the things that may be going on is that why the number of new species may be sort of plateauing, or the rate of arrival of new species, is that to a certain extent, there are some species that are strongly associated with certain invasion pathways. In a sense, they're sort of the easy invaders. We've already established a lot of them, and so now we're getting to the sort of hard invaders. Even though global trade is increasing, et cetera, the ones that are very easy to establish may have already established here. But the other way of looking at that is if you look at the graph I showed before was basically of all non-indigenous forest insects, and here is basically just sort of a timeline of discoveries, not necessarily establishment, but discoveries of all of what we call kind of the big ones, the poster pests. Certainly if you look over the last 10 or 20 years, we've had a kind of major cluster of new discoveries. And so it may be that for some reason or another, even though the number of new species is arriving, it may be that the number of like sort of really bad species is not necessarily plateauing or going down and may still actually be going up. Now I'm going to sort of switch gears and kind of talk about, so when we're looking at the number of new species coming here, what is it that we really do or can do to exclude species? And I think in this kind of context, it's always really important to consider, this is what someone mentioned the Holy Trinity. This is what I sort of think of the Holy Trinity of invasion biology. You always have to consider there are three important processes, components, phases of every invasion, arrival, establishment, and spread. And certainly there are corresponding management activities that go on to prevent both of these phases, that we use quarantine and inspection to minimize the arrival of new species. We use detection and eradication to prevent establishment, and then barrier zones to prevent spread. And most of our effort in invasive species really focuses on quarantine and inspection, because I think it's been pointed out by many people, this is maybe where you can have the biggest payoff. If you can exclude them to begin with, then you don't have to deal with them later on. And I know it's not terribly exciting for everyone to see an organizational chart of the USDA, but I just wanted to point out that the animal plant health inspection, as many of you probably know, in the United States has the primary responsibility for establishing quarantines and doing inspection to exclude pests at ports. As also probably many of you know, that in 2003, with the formation of the Department of Homeland Security, this is, by the way, another slide that I stole from Deb, with the Department of Homeland Security was formed, and the port inspection, the actual people on the ground in the ports were all transferred to the Homeland Security, to the Customs and Border Patrol. And there's been recent, this year, testimony in the U.S. Congress in which there is basically a study by the GAO to study the effects of this change. And it's pretty clear from their testimony that basically things have really gone downhill, that basically there's been a decrease in the number of inspections and a decrease in the interception of alien species at ports of entry. So this is probably, for those of us who are interested in minimizing the problem of alien species, this is obviously a problem. I think there might be reason to believe that even prior to 1993, to 2003, there was, even within APHIS, there was a problem. This is just a graph from one of our earlier publications showing that the purple line shows the ever-increasing number of air passengers. This is with air baggage. And the green line shows the number of interceptions in air baggage. In other words, the number of contaminated things like fruits and whatnot that were discovered. And so what you can see is that the green line, the number of detections, didn't really increase with the increasing air travel. And I suppose a person could argue that maybe air travelers are being more careful. I don't think that's the reason. I think that it's much more likely that basically at this time APHIS wasn't able to keep up with the number of increasing air travel. And I think that's generally the case, that as air travel, international business and cargo movement has increased, Our ability to inspect cargo and baggage is not kept up. Now, obviously, for the wood, for in forestry, our one of the most important pathways for the arrival of non-indigenous forest pests is solid wood packing material. And this is actually some data from one of Bob Hack's papers, just showing the distribution among these different invasion of solid wood packing materials that the different wood-boring insects arrive. In this respect, there's a little bit of optimism because in the recent, there have been the new ISPM agreement puts forth a new regulations for that regulate the movement of untreated wood packing material. And I think that this may, basically what the rule does is the idea is to ban the movement of solid wood packing material that hasn't either been heat treated or fumigated. And in theory, this should greatly reduce the number of arrivals by wood boring insects. I think that as I understand it, the program still is not fully implemented, and maybe not all countries are following it. And I think even if all countries do follow it, there probably will continue to be some pretty important pathways for wood-boring insects to enter the U.S. that maybe aren't covered by aren't necessarily classified as solid wood pack material. This is just an example in furniture, which is many people have recognized recently as another important pathway for wood-boring insects. I just wanted to bring up here one last thing of when we compare, we look in the U.S. what we're doing about to minimize the arrival of new alien species. It's pretty interesting to compare what goes on here with what goes in New Zealand. New Zealand being a country of only 4 million people, whereas the U.S. is over 300 million people. But it's a country where biosecurity, they use the word biosecurity, and it's one of these unfortunate things. I think in the U.S. now, biosecurity means something to do with terrorism, whereas in New Zealand and elsewhere, biosecurity refers to quarantine issues. For those of you who've been to New Zealand, every baggage article that enters the country is X-rayed, and they're not looking for bombs. They're looking for smuggled fruit and whatnot. They also, for every shipping container that enters the country, is inspected either by government or non-government personnel. And it's an issue that's very high-profile issue. They even have a little newspaper called Container Watch, which is fascinating reading. The other thing is you can look at, it's not just minimizing arrival. New Zealand has had some great successes in eradicating some newly discovered species. The white-spotted tussock moth, which is another and the painted apple moth, both of which were exotic Lyman triads, were eradicated at great expense in the Auckland area recently. And in the case of the painted apple moth, it was eradicated using a combination of aerial spraying with BT with sterile insect releases. Some of the residential areas in Auckland were treated over 24 times, I understand, with BT, which is something I know here in California with the light brown apple moth eradication programs being proposed now that people are objecting to being sprayed with pheromone flakes. But in New Zealand, the public is willing to tolerate being sprayed 24 times with BT. And I think that part of the reason for this difference is that in New Zealand, the whole issue of alien species is something that's a very high profile issue in the public. You could go on the street and everyone would be able to tell you some kind of experience they have with alien species, whether it's plants or insects. There's even a reality TV show called Border Patrol, which follows inspectors at airports and shipping terminals. And in the U.S., I think if you asked an average person on the street what they think of invasive species, they'd have no idea what you were talking about. So I think that's one of the main reasons why us as a country, we're doing a little bit of a pathetic job at inspection and quarantine. Is the issue just hasn't reached that level of awareness. I think my guess is eventually we're going to get there. Again, New Zealand, they've had a lot of really horrific problems with invasive species. In the U.S., I think they maybe haven't been quite as horrific, but I imagine maybe they will eventually. Again, if you look at, to me, it's one of the interesting things. We've really comes down to most of our invaders, forest invaders, have been in the Northeast, but it's where we have diverse forests. So you, chestnut blight wiped out all the American chestnut. It, in a way, it was no big deal because there are oaks and other species that in many ways are very similar, so the general public really never noticed it. I guess I've sometimes made this point that if we were to have something like chestnut blight that wiped out ponderosa pine, say, which has a very wide distribution and very often occurs in monocultures of naturally occurring monocultures, if that species were to be wiped out, we'd have forests that would no longer be forests. And so maybe, and that, I guess that's the point I'm trying to make, is I'm afraid that we're not going to get to the point of the issue of invasive species is not going to be the same level as it is in countries like New Zealand, probably until we have a disaster like that, unfortunately. So with that cheery note, one other thing I was going to mention, which I think is a little bit of a problem too, is that even though we have this increasing problem, I believe, with invasive species, we have a decreasing number of people working on it. This is just a little graph showing the depressing reality of the number of people like me, which are research entomologists and pathologists in the U.S. Forest Service. If you were to continue these numbers back into the 70s, it would even be higher and continually going down. So even though the problem is getting bigger, the number of scientists working on it goes down. I think to a certain extent within the APHIS, there's been somewhat of a recognition of the lack of people doing research, and that's why we've had things like the Center for Plant Health Science and Technology, which CEPHIS has, is a group within APHIS that centers on sort of technology. They don't use the word research, technology development. That the problem is that technically CEPHIS is not really a research agency, and it may seem like a trivial thing, but I think it makes a big deal. It actually ends up being a important thing because it's not, if you're not publishing papers and this sort of thing, I don't think that we really need to have a scientific agency that focuses on invasive species in this country. And what I would argue would be that right now we have within the USDA, we have the Forest Service and the Agricultural Research Service, which are doing research, but they're not part of APHIS and probably should be. Or some research agency should be part of APHIS. And so the final note, I guess I see this analogy, maybe you may remember Richard Clark from the 9/11 hearings, who said that he failed the country. And I think to a certain extent that us in the USDA and maybe in the entomology community in general, to a certain extent we're failing the public in that the problem is not being solved, and we really need to work to find ways to solve it. So with that cheery note, that's it. Yeah.
I'm going to do is spend probably half the talk just sort of putting some definition to Ali effects, and then what I'll try to do in the latter half of my talk is to put this into some context within biological invasion. So Ali effects, they actually are named after someone. It's named after an ecologist quite some time ago. I think it was around right when Sandy was coming out of graduate school or so. But he studied He studied animal ecology, and he was really fascinating with animal aggregations. And he was really one of the first to recognize the fact that populations must have some minimum number of individuals to remain viable. And in doing so, he came up with this idea that certain things might cause a population to be driven towards extinction, and that there was some threshold below which this would occur. And some of his, really, what he was really interested in is he was really fascinated with aggregations within the animal kingdom, including humans. He was very interested in how aggregations formed. Some of his initial stuff was done on aquatic species, where he learned that, where he observed that aquatic species was sort of, could sort of condition the environment and actually provide some sort of protection from whatever pollutants or so forth were in the water. He's also one of the first people, ecologists, to actually use statistics, which is kind of another contribution. So at the time, you have to put this into context what the general ecological community was thinking. It was really driven by this concept of negative density dependence, whereas, and we're all familiar with this concept, that at very low population densities, you don't really see a whole lot of intraspecific interference, and until you get large enough numbers, you start dealing with competition, and that's when populations start going down towards a carrying capacity. And what he argued was that it could be a completely different relationship. You could have actually negative population growth rate at very low densities. You still see a carrying capacity effect, but it wasn't just because there weren't any competitors, there wasn't any need to compete with conspecifics, doesn't necessarily mean that the population was going to thrive. And actually, one of his first quantified examples was with an insect, the confused flower beetle, where he put in a dish with the same amount of flour or whatever, different populations of beetles. And what he noticed was, the first thing he noticed was that at very high densities, basically the adults couldn't get enough food, so they started eating the eggs, you know, carrying capacity concept. But what he noticed that when he put one male and one female together, even though they had no problems finding each other, they just didn't seem to produce that many eggs, and he just related to, well, the females weren't stimulated enough. I'm not sure if that's, maybe there's some analogy to human populations, I don't know. But certainly, you know, not having enough potential mates from which to choose didn't seem to get them aroused. So let me talk a little bit about just mechanisms of an alley effect. And I don't want to be, argue between the groupers and the splitters. So I'm just going to be very broad here. The first one has to do with sex. Very interesting concept, I think. Reproduction, how mates find each other in a very vast world. The second one, I have to credit my five-year-old. I had a really hard time coming up with a song that sort of related to eating. And I asked my five-year-old, and he came up with Fruit Salad Yummy Yummy, which is a song by the Wiggles. Those of you who have kids probably know the Wiggles. If you don't buy the CD because you will not get the words out of your head. You'll find yourself singing these songs to yourself when you're driving to work. But certainly another concept of an alley effect is finding food and also exploiting food resources. And the last one is being attacked or being fed upon by something else. And if you think about, most species, past and present, have been herbivores. Dinosaurs are mostly herbivores. Certainly most of the species alive today are herbivores. So I think it's fair to say that most species have spent or are spending some part of their time dealing with things that want to eat them. So I think this is an important effect as well. So let me start with the reproduction part. And this is actually lifted completely, plagiarized from this book that's coming out on alley effects in ecology and conservation. But it has to do with mate finding. And if you think about insects, certainly insects have evolved these really complex ways to find each other, but they still have to find each other. They're still very, very small organisms in a very vast area, and often they're in very fragmented habitats. And just finding each other, even something like gypsy moth, which has the males have these great antennae, very plumose, they still got to find females. Everybody got that? You can read it from the book too. And in gypsy moth, it's been documented many, many times by different people over different times in different areas that the probability of a, let me use the laser pointer, the probability of if you took a female and tethered her to a tree and you related whether or not she got mated by the background male moth density, that you would see this kind of effect. You would see very little chance of getting mated at very low densities, and certainly at high densities you would see pretty much they all got mated. It's not, the alley effect is certainly not restricted to just insects or just to the animal kingdom. There's actually been shown quite a bit in plants and in very specialized systems like fig trees and a very specialized wasp. It's been shown by several people as well. Lekking, which is a type of behavior where males sort of get together, and the birds of paradise are a good example. They do these bizarre mating rituals. It's been shown that the bigger the lek size, the more likely that a female will choose that particular that particular group. Cooperative breeding, another good example where you certainly need more. You need a number of individuals. Bees are a good example. There's quite a bit of interest in colony collapse disorder. Certainly, the more bees you have, the better, the more likely you are to take care of young. African wild dog. I'll talk a little bit about these a little bit later. These are like the poster child for species conservation and alley dynamics. I'll mention them a little bit later, but they certainly do cooperative breeding. Next one, eating. And if you've been watching the news, you probably know about the big jellyfish swarm off the coast of Scotland that completely took out I don't know how many millions of dollars worth of salmon from a salmon farm. But certainly jellyfish would be one example of something that certainly does well.